welcome to the Mariner's Library with me, Chris Danmore Major. And in this episode, we're continuing the book The Venturesome Voyages of Captain Voss by Captain J.C. Voss. We're on Chapter 5 of the second book, and this is the seventh part of the reading. And if you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner, and there for $5 a month you can help support this podcast and keep the information contained within these fantastic books easily available for the next generation. Now on with the story. Chapter 5. The Calm Belt and Land in Sight. After the gale, the weather settled fine and clear, with a nice steady northerly breeze, the Tillicum making from 100 to 150 miles a day. On July the 17th, shortly after breakfast, we sighted a sail on our starboard bow, apparently a sailing vessel standing to the eastward. I changed our course to meet the stranger. The wind was rather light during the forenoon, and it took us quite a while till we met, which was at about 11 o'clock. When alongside, we found the vessel was the U.S. barkentine Mary Winkleman from Honolulu with a cargo of sugar and bound for San Francisco. The captain and his wife invited us on board for dinner, but as there was quite a large sea running at the time, we were afraid of something happening to our little canoe if she was brought up alongside the side of the barkentine by one of the seas. "Would you like to have some fresh bread?" the captain's wife asked us. We gratefully accepted the offer, and the captain lowered a few loaves. After comparing longitudes, we said goodbye, and we put the Tillicum on her southerly course. The place where we met the Mary Winkleman was about 350 miles southwest of San Francisco. Just as I swung the Tillicum on her course, the captain shouted, "I will report you when I get to San Francisco," which he did, as I found out later. The wind kept light during the afternoon, but at 3 o'clock the barkentine was again out of sight, and we were once more left by ourselves on the ocean. Alone, alone, all alone, alone on a wide, wide sea. The weather kept fine and clear day after day, and the wind kept light and variable from the north. Averaging about 100 miles a day, we soon got into the northeast trade wind, which was also moderate with fine, clear weather. A freshwater yachtsman could have sailed the Tillicum through that part of the Pacific. My mate thought then that our troubles were over and that we had nothing but fine weather and smooth sailing before us. The weather was certainly fine, and our sailing was as smooth as any sailing could possibly be. But as we were approaching the equator, the weather got warmer and warmer every day. It finally got so hot that it was next to an impossibility to sleep in the cabin. As soon as we lay down, the sweat would just run out of us. Then again, in sitting in the cockpit, we could not keep our eyes open while steering. Still, the latter had to be done at all costs. One night, while I was asleep during my watch below, I heard the sails flapping and woke up. I said to myself, "Hello, my mate is asleep at the helm." Thereupon, I looked out of the cabin door, and there he was, his head swinging from side to side and the boat up in the wind. "Wake up out there," I shouted. He woke up all right, and then denied that he had been sleeping, and having no room for settling arguments on the Tillicum, I dropped the matter. Day after day, the northeast wind kept light, and some days we only made about 50 miles. The weather also kept pretty warm. About a week later, my mate again fell asleep at the rudder, and the flapping of the sails woke me up. Looking out of the companionway, I saw him in the same condition as before. The night was dark and cloudy, and he could not see me from outside, so I took a bucket full of seawater, and from the inside of the cabin, poured the water over his head and laid down again, without him seeing me. As I said before, my mate was a newspaper man, and therefore knew how to string language, but I don't think Mr. Luxton would like to see in print the language he used, so I shall keep it out, just to oblige him. About 3 hours later, I got up and, as usual, said, "Good morning, Norman." He did not speak, but looked very cross at me. "What is the matter, Norman? Don't you feel well?" I asked him. "Look here, John," he said, "this boat should be put in a glass case instead of on the sea." "Why?" I asked. "A vessel that ships seas in this kind of weather should never sail outside of a mill pond." And then he used some more of his own special brand of language. I don't think he knew that I had thrown the water, but by considering it later on, he thought differently, for Some nights afterwards, I got the same kind of a C over me. But all I said the next morning was, "I agree with what you said, Norman. This boat should be in a glass case or on a mill pond." In the latter part of July, when in latitude 17 degrees north and longitude 125 west, the trade wind became very light and the sky cloudy. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, a heavy westerly squall accompanied by rain struck the Tillicum, which made us take in sail pretty quickly. The squall was short and sweet, but I knew then, by the way the weather acted, that we had sailed out of the northeast trade wind and got into what is called the calm belt or doldrums. It is rather unusual, and certainly very unlucky, to lose the northeast trade wind as soon as that, as it generally means a long spell of dirty and contrary weather, which we certainly got. Why that part of the ocean is called the calm belt, I don't understand, because from the trouble we had there with the Tillicum, and also from former experiences, I should call it anything but that. The belt of the seaman's trouble would be a far more suitable name. For 16 long days and nights, we had nothing but trouble with the weather and the sails. It was up sails and down sails, hauling in sheets or slacking them all the time. During that time, we experienced about 50 changes of weather every day. It would be pouring with rain for a little while, and then the sun would blaze down on us. The next thing would be a heavy squall of wind and rain combined, but my mate and I stuck to it. I don't think either of us ever dozed at the rudder while going through this belt of trouble. The distance to the nearest land about the time we were going through all that drilling was about 1,500 miles, so there was no chance of running in somewhere and tying up to a tree, as we did on Vancouver Island. One day, a heavy squall of wind and rain came in from the southwest, which made me take in every sail when it struck us, but in about 10 minutes' time the squall hauled round by the way of the north, east, and then southeast, after which the rain stopped, the sky cleared, and the wind became a steady fresh breeze, which soon convinced me that we were now in the southeast trade wind. We were then in about 5 degrees north latitude and 128 degrees west longitude, and our course to the Marquesas Islands, about south-southwest, distant 1,000 miles. In sailing by the wind, we could have made the Marquesas Islands all right, but owing to the wind being too strong, almost too strong for the Tillicum to sail by the wind, we changed our minds, and instead of steering for the Marquesas, shaped our course for Penryn Island, in latitude 8 degrees 55 minutes south, and longitude 158 degrees 6 minutes west. The southeast trade wind was a good leading wind for us to Penryn, and as it gradually hauled into the east-southeast, it was still better, for this gave us the wind on the port quarter, which the Tillicum liked best of all. In a few days, we crossed the equator, after which we had about as much wind as we could take care of. Under all sail, we were running off 150 to 170 miles a day, and the best day's run we got out of the Tillicum, which was also the record for the whole voyage, was 177 miles. My mate was by that time an excellent helmsman, otherwise he could never have done it, for we had to keep her going every minute to get that distance out of her. The strong trade wind threw up a large sea, which sometimes would break quite heavily, and when a breaker came along with its roaring noise, my mate would twist his head from one side to the other, watching it coming. Now and then he would say, "John, I think we had better heave her to. I don't like this. I'm getting nervous." "Well, there's no time to heave to round here," I said. "Just watch the forward end of the boat and the compass and keep her on her course and you'll be all right." There was no time for dozing at the rudder then, as carelessness in steering just about that time would have had a bad effect. But as long as she was kept on her course, the Tillicum was quite safe. Of course, at times, the water would wash over the deck, and at times it would even come into the cockpit and give us a good soaking, but the weather being warm, we did not mind that in the least. At any rate, we kept the Tillicum sailing on her western course till September 1st, at dark, when, according to my reckoning, we should be very near Penryn Island. We hove to for the night and waited for daylight next morning, after which we kept her before the southeast trade wind again. At 7 o'clock, as usual, we had our breakfast, and while we were eating, my mate said, "I bet that old Waltham watch of yours got out of time, and we will not be able to find the island." At that time, according to my reckoning, we should only be about 12 miles from the island, and I was just about thinking myself that there was something wrong with my navigation. Still, I did not want to let on to my mate what I apprehended. That morning, we had been 58 days at sea, and both of us felt we would like to get on solid land once more and stretch our legs. Penryn Island was given in my sailing directory as a low island about 8 miles wide, which could be seen from a ship's deck about 8 or 9 miles distant. By being a little out in navigation, we might have sailed by without seeing it, but still, as our distance was not quite up, I was still in hopes of making it. At any rate, I kept steering the same course as before. My mate was in the cabin washing the breakfast dishes, at the same time grumbling and growling about my only taking an ordinary Waltham watch for a chronometer, and what would become of us if we did not make land, etc. I could not help listening to him grumbling, but at the same time was almost looking the eyes out of my head trying to find the land. The sky was as clear could be, and my mate was still at the dishes when I thought I saw something ahead of me that looked like land. But it disappeared again just as fast as it had appeared above the horizon. I kept looking in that direction, and in a minute or two I saw the same thing again. "Land ahead!" I shouted. In a second my mate was alongside me saying, "Where?" It had disappeared again, and as my mate could not see it, he looked at me. But before he said what he intended, I saw it again. "There it is," I said. And this time we both saw it, and also knew it was real land. Chapter 6. Penryn Island. On seeing the land, my mate got so excited that he threw his hat up in the air and gave 3 cheers for Old Canada. Unfortunately, the hat went overboard, and I had to tack the ship to pick it up. When we got near the island, we saw that it was very small, and being covered with coconut trees, it looked rather wild. My South Pacific sailing directory said that the natives on Penryn were not to be trusted, and as we were only 2 in a very small boat, I must frankly admit that I did not care about making a landing on that lonely, little, out-of-the-way island in the great Pacific Ocean, and amongst a lot of people who were perhaps cannibals. Therefore, I told my mate we had better keep on sailing till we came to Samoa. I surely thought that this advice would have found favour with Luxton, but instead of that he blew up like a stick of dynamite. "What do you mean by suggesting that we pass by an island like this, the most interesting place we can go to? Never! We must go in at all costs. That is what I have come out for, to see small out-of-the-way islands and people, and if you look at your agreement you will find it is so. No, John, don't talk to me like that." Of course, I knew that our agreement called for visiting small inhabited and uninhabited islands, and also that my mate had made up his mind to call in, and it was of no use for me to say any more about it. So I said, "Well, all right, Norman, we will go in, but by all means let us go about it in a careful way," to which he readily agreed. The island was described in the sailing directory as being a low, round-shaped lagoon island and inhabited by 400 South Sea Islanders who were not to be trusted, and that there were several entrances into the lagoon, one in particular on the east and another on the north side. With the fresh east-southeasterly trade wind, we steered for the eastern entrance, and I said to myself, "If the natives do get after us, the easterly wind will also be a fair wind to take us through the lagoon and out of the northern channel." With our 4 100-pound bags of sand, which we used as shifting ballast, we fortified ourselves in the cockpit, and with all our firearms loaded and lying alongside us, ready for instant use, we sailed in for the east end of the island. We soon got near the east coast, but could not see the entrance into the lagoon. We then shaped our course along the coast to the northward and saw 2 wrecks of large sailing vessels lying in amongst the rocks and breakers. They were lying abeam 1/4 mile apart. One of them was pretty well broken up, but the other was lying on her side with the hull apparently still in fairly good condition. Shortly after passing the 2 ill-fated vessels, we saw the roofs of some buildings quite away in amongst the coconut trees, but so far no entrance to the lagoon. We kept on, following the coast to the northward, and finally reached the gap we were looking for. It was about 1/2 mile wide, and there were large breakers at the entrance. We could see from the outside, while still sailing amongst the large seas, the perfectly smooth, shining water of the lagoon, and as we got nearer and nearer, could see small boats and canoes sailing on the lagoon. My mate said, "Now just look at that picture. It is the finest I've ever seen. Such a fine, smooth piece of water with small boats sailing about in different directions, with the bright morning sun shining on all of it, it gives the water a silvery colour. Just look at the sails of the boats and the canoes as white as snow, with all kinds of tropical birds flying about, and all this surrounded by a ring of green coconut trees. Well, John, he continued, there is no artist in the world that can make a picture look so beautiful as this. And to think that you wanted to pass this place without calling in. You may change your mind when you meet the locals, I replied. As we still had the strong east-northeast trade wind driving us along, we soon got out of the large seas and into smooth water. The strip of land round the lagoon was only about half a mile wide, and as soon as we got through the entrance, we changed our course along the land towards the south, where we had seen signs of habitation shortly before. While sailing along near the land, we saw several native men among the coconut trees with very scanty clothing on. I said to my mate, "Those fellows may have us for supper tonight." "If they do, they will have to fight hard for it," he replied. We continued sailing along the land and soon saw some houses near the water's edge. Next, the village came into full view, and not far from the village lay a fine-looking schooner painted white. To all appearances, it was a European vessel, and to make sure, we hoisted our little Canadian flag, which was answered at once from the schooner, which proved to be a Frenchman. Neither of us could speak a word of French, but, as I told my mate, in all my travels, I have been on vessels of every nation and have never yet found a ship on which there wasn't someone who could speak English. At any rate, we changed our course and steered for the schooner, and in about 15 minutes were alongside her. The first words we heard from the French vessel were, in plain English, "Take your sails in and we will give you a line to tie up with." With that, one of the sailors threw a line across our bow. We soon lowered our sails and made fast to the schooner. "Where are you from?" was the next question from the deck of the schooner. "From Victoria, BC," I answered. "Come on board," the same voice said. One of the seamen put a ladder over the side of the schooner and both of us clambered up. The first to greet us was a strong, heavy-set man. He shook hands with us and said in good English, "My name is Dexter. Allow me to welcome you gentlemen on board my vessel." Captain Dexter then introduced us to Mr. Winchester. Dexter, an American, and Winchester, an Englishman, were partners in the schooner and were trading among the South Pacific Islands. We were hardly on board the schooner when the chief of the village came off to welcome us to his island. Soon after that, natives, old and young, came off in their canoes and boats to get a glimpse of the strangers. The natives certainly looked very much better than I had pictured them in my mind. They were quite tall and well-built and apparently very polite. Some of the women with long black hair hanging down their backs were exceedingly beautiful and all wore calico dresses which were as white as snow. During the afternoon, Captain Dexter took us on shore to the house of the chief, who treated us to some coconut milk served in coconut shell, after which we were conducted through the village. The houses, which were built of wood and covered with dried coconut leaves, were mostly situated along the waterfront. "Where'd you get all the North American pine from?" I said, seeing that all the houses were built of that lumber. "Oh, did you see the two wrecks just outside the entrance when you came in?" Captain Dexter asked. I replied in the affirmative. "Well," he said, "one of them came along here a few years ago with a cargo of lumber for Australia and got stranded here. The crew managed to get ashore, and as the vessel broke up, the lumber drifted in, and naturally, the locals helped themselves. The crew stopped here 3 months, waiting for a vessel to come along to take them off. But they waited in vain. Eventually, they decked over the lifeboats, which they had saved from the wreck, and sailed to Samoa in them. From Samoa, they took a steamer for Sydney, where the loss of the ship and cargo was reported. The captain's wife also got lost in the wreck. She was lost because her husband had the same idea as I had, that the natives were murderers and cannibals. When the vessel struck, the boats were lowered, and to keep out of the hands of the natives, the captain ordered the crew to pull towards the sea, instead of for the shore. The boat which held the captain and his wife was overturned in the breakers, and the poor woman was drowned. All the rest got ashore and were received with open arms by the natives on the island. The owners of the lost cargo at once sent for a duplicate cargo, and a vessel was chartered. After the cargo was put on board, she set sail for Australia, but she also only got as far as Penryn Island, where she piled up on a dark night alongside the other one. no doubt. Many of my readers will think this is a most wonderful story, and so did I. When I got to London, I went to the trouble of seeing the secretary of Lloyd's, who assured me that the story was correct. These were the two wrecks we saw when coming in, and from which the natives got the lumber to build their town. I asked Captain Dexter how the natives made a living, to which he replied that the natives of the South Sea, in their own way, are the most independent people in the world. "To start with," he continued, "you see for yourself that this, like all the rest of the Low Islands, is covered with coconut trees, which are the most profitable tree they have. The wood is hard and can be used for any kind of woodwork. The leaves are used to make different kinds of plain and fancy hats, cloths, mats, baskets, brooms, scrubbers, house roofing, fish corrals, and to make large flare-ups for the purpose of attracting flying fish to the canoes in which they set out to catch them. The sap of the coconut tree is obtained from the blossom, and as much as a gallon and a half can be extracted from a single tree. This sap, when fresh, tastes like excellent cool cider. If left standing for a day, it turns into syrup, and in 2 or 3 days it becomes a liquor similar to rum, and very little of it will make a man intoxicated. If the sap is not drawn out of the tree, it will grow coconuts. Each full-grown tree will have about 100 nuts. There are 4 different kinds of trees, bearing the red, white, blue, and sweet coconuts. The latter is the most profitable, as the nut husk, when green, is very good eating. Its taste is very much like sugarcane. All coconuts, when green, are full of milk. The milk itself is a sweet, cool drink and must be very nutritious. While I was cruising round the South Sea Islands, I drank nothing else and never felt better in my life. When the nuts are soft, they are also very good eating. The husk of the ripe coconut is splendid fuel, and it will also make good rope, fishing lines and nets. The shells can be used for all kinds of drinking vessels and dishes. And when the nut is ripe, the kernel is taken from the shell and ground up fine, after which it is pressed and a liquor is extracted which tastes very much like cow's milk. On boiling the liquor, it is transformed into a white oil and can be utilized for cooking and illumination purposes. It is also used by the native women for hair oil, and if rubbed into the skin will repel all kinds of insects. It also has excellent healing properties. Besides all this, the nut is converted into copper by drying, and shiploads of this material are sent to Europe and United States, where it is manufactured into soap and other articles. When a coconut is ripe, it will drop to the ground. If left lying on a moist ground, the nut will quickly sprout from one of the eyes, one part descending into the ground to form the roots, and the other part growing upwards. In about 6 years, it develops into a full-grown tree. If the sprout is removed and the coconut opened, instead of the nut, what looks and tastes very much like sponge cake will be found, and one of them is just about enough to make a meal. Breadfruit and other tropical fruits are scarce on the low coral islands of the South Pacific. Besides the coconut, there are the arrowroot, yam and taro, the latter plant growing to a very large size. The pigs and poultry on the island are chiefly raised on coconuts. The waters both in the lagoon and along the outside coast are full of fish. The natives catch many by building a fire on the beach, towards which the fish will swim, only to be captured with a dip net. Some are caught by nets or hooks made of pearl shell. The best sport of all is catching flying fish. To do this, 3 natives take a canoe outside the lagoon. One of the 3 sits in the stern and paddles her along. The second stands up in the middle of the boat, holding up a large flare made of dried coconut leaves, and the 3rd man in the front end of the canoe stands with a long-handled dip net and is kept busy catching the flying fish on the wing as they make for the fire. In the Penryn Island Lagoon, pearl oyster shell is also very plentiful, and it is a good source of income to the natives who dispose of it to traders, the proceeds of which are nearly equally shared amongst all the inhabitants of the island. The land also is divided in the same way. Some of the islands have a king, and others call their leader chief, but both have full power over the natives and are very much respected. Only on one occasion have I seen a South Sea Islander drunk, the chief of the island being very severe with those found guilty of this weakness. His best friends got hold of the man before the chief got to hear about it, and took him down to the beach where, in spite of all his kicking and shouting, they put him under the water and held him there till I felt very sure the poor fellow was drowned. After a while they made him stand up, but following a period of sniffing and blowing, he started to kick up Old Harry again, so down he went once more under the water. The next time they pulled him up, he behaved a little more civilly, but was not quite enough to suit his friends, who thought it advisable to give him another ducking. This time when he rose, or rather was raised, they took him to the beach, and after rolling the water out of him, he appeared to be very weak but quite sober, and without a word to say. I thought to myself then that if a similar remedy could be applied to some people I know of, what a blessing it would prove to be to themselves and to others. I was told by the natives that three dips is a sure cure for dipsomania. We stopped only one day at the eastern village, as the next morning Captain Dexter sailed across the lagoon, a distance of about 7 miles, to the village on the west side of the island, and we went along with the schooner. The lagoon is very deep in places, but there are also plenty of spots where coral rocks are just high enough to make it dangerous for vessels to sail about. But at the same time, they can be easily avoided by sailing through after 10 o'clock in the morning when the sun is well up. By keeping a good lookout from the bow, or better still, from the end of the jibboom or masthead with the sun at your back, the rocks can be seen a long way off. We dropped anchor at the western village about an hour after leaving the other one. This village was similar in appearance, the houses also being built along the shore of the lagoon. The chief came on board our little vessel and asked if I would like to have her taken out of the water and cleaned up. I stated that it was my intention to give her a good cleaning and painting before we sailed. The next morning, the chief sent natives down to me to take on shore all the stores and ballast, after which they pulled the tillicum out of the water and placed her high and dry amongst the coconut trees. They then scrubbed her inside and out, and after she was properly clean and dry again, painted her. The third day after our arrival at the western village, the British cruiser Torch arrived, and after dropping anchor outside of the western bay, Commander McAllister came on shore with some of the officers and men. Penryn Island is under British protection, and a cruiser calls there once a year to see that everything is all right. Commander McAllister, during his short stay of 2 days at the island, inspected the tillicum and also some of my charts. I was only in possession of one blue-backed chart of the South Pacific Ocean. Commander McAllister told me I had not sufficient charts to sail through the South Pacific, and as I was unable to buy any charts at the island, he was good enough to present me with several, which were very valuable to me later on in making certain islands. After the Torch left, Captain Dexter sailed across the lagoon to the eastern village, where he had some business to look after. And as he was only to be away for a few days, my mate went along, and I stopped with the tillicum till the schooner came back, which was on the 17th of September. The next day, the tillicum was put into the water, the ballast and stores placed on board again, and she was ready for sea. On the morning of September 19th, I got up at daybreak to get things ready for an early start. I saw the natives rushing about and bringing coconuts down to the tillicum, and if I had left them alone, they would, I think, have sunk our little vessel with coconuts and other eatables. However, when I considered she was deep enough loaded, I told the good chief that the boat could not possibly take any more. We thanked him for all his kindness, and while saying goodbye, the tears came to our eyes. After shaking hands with all the natives, my mate and I stepped on board, set all sails, and with our little Canadian flag on the mizzen, we took our departure from Penryn Island. The natives gave us three cheers in true English style as we slowly sailed away from the village, which we answered by three dips of our flag as a final farewell. Well, that's all for today. I hope you're enjoying the story so far. The next instalment will be available in the Mariner's Library shortly. And remember, of course, you've got all the content over on YouTube and the Mariner podcast, and of course Patreon at patreon.com/themariner. But for now, wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I hope that you're safe and sound, and I look forward to speaking to you in the next one. Cheers.